Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Grapevine Open Meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm Chris, and I am an alcoholic. I'll be your host for the month of February. This is the AA preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of people who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. You can enjoy the Grapevine Open Meetings every Wednesday at noon Eastern Time on this virtual platform. The meeting will be recorded and will be posted as an audio podcast every Friday on all podcast platforms, on aagrapevine.org and on YouTube. This is an open meeting. Everyone is welcome. We are glad you're all here, especially newcomers. If you are new to AA and want to learn more about our program of recovery from alcoholism, we encourage you to find an AA group in your area. Contact with group members will help you to find a sponsor and help you to learn about the AA program of recovery from alcoholism. This is today's Grapevine Daily Quote. My job is to achieve through humility to see myself in others and to accept both myself and others by identifying. The willingness to make amends will grow from this act of love. And that's from an article called 8 and a Half from Bowling Green, Kentucky, October 1986. And it's also in the Best of the Grapevine, Volume 2. You can sign up to receive the daily quote as a daily email at aagrapevine.org, or you will find it on the Grapevine app every morning. This is an excerpt from this month's Grapevine magazine. This is in the letter section, and it's called My God-Shaped Hole. I once tried to fill my God-shaped hole with booze every day. Had that been successful, I would still be doing it. But it turned out to be my greatest failure. When I got to AA, I saw millions of people like me had found a solution to that God-shaped hole. So I thought I would give it a try and do what they did to fill that God-shaped hole. Well, do you know what I discovered? God fills that space when God wants. I used to have a hole about the size of a coffee can. Because of the steps, my God-shaped hole is a minuscule portion of my universe. Today, I have 35 years of contented sobriety. I've been freed from alcohol. I let God take care of that God-shaped hole. That frees me up to help others. And that was submitted by Anonymous. Let's also start today's meeting with a quick reading from the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is the beginning of Chapter 7, Working with Others. Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intense work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry the message to alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. Life will take on new meaning to watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. Okay, this will be a two-speaker meeting. There will be no sharing by attendees, so please sit back, relax, and listen. I love open meetings because there's no pressure, except for the two speakers, of course. We often hear it is best to try to identify with the speakers rather than compare your stories with theirs. I met Liz. Liz was the chair of the Grapevine Conference Committee, and we became fast friends, and we're in contact every couple months, it seems, and I'm very happy about that. And please let me introduce Liz.
Thank you, Chris. My name is Liz, and I'm an alcoholic, and it's an honor to be thought of to do this. My sobriety date is March the 20th of 1997, and God willing, I will pick up a 29-year chip next month in my home group, which is the Pembroke Group here in Area 16, Georgia. I live in Savannah, Georgia, but I grew up in Virginia, and I grew up to a family of people who drank every day. I grew up kind of as an only child. I did have older siblings, but they were out of the house from my memory. I think there was one that came during college during the summer, but really I grew up as an only child and mom and dad drank every day. And I can't say that they were alcoholic. I can say that they drank every day. But here's the thing. At the end of their life, my dad took a fall and I went home to visit and I went to pour their wine at dinner. And mom said, "Don't pour any for me. I quit." And I'm like, "Well, what do you mean you quit?" She said, "Well, I want to be present in case your dad falls again." And I thought, oh my gosh, I need like a full program and 12 steps in order to be able to not drink. And she's drank every day of her life and just decided not to drink anymore because she wants to be present. Well, it talks about that in the book when it says if they have a sufficiently strong reason, they can quit. And so she did. So my mom and dad, or at least my mom anyway, wasn't an alcoholic. My dad might still be out for the jury, but you know, he ended up passing away. They both did. And I'm now an orphan. But I grew up in this drinking home. And so I was never discouraged to drink. And I can't really tell you when my first drink was, because there's pictures of me in a high chair with a jelly jar half full of beer picking crabs. I mean, I grew up on a tributary off of the Chesapeake Bay. But I will say that I can remember the first time that I sought out alcohol of my own accord. And mom and dad were very good to me. They gave me ballet lessons and drama classes and things. And so I was involved in this production and I was about 11 or 12 years old. And after the production, they had a cast party that had champagne and some other things. And so me and a couple of the other little girls stole a couple bottles of champagne and those little cups that have the bottoms that fall off, those little champagne glasses, those little plastic ones. And everybody had a glass and I drank the rest. I know that sounds crazy, but that was just how it started. And quite honestly, it didn't change much over time. I was always the type of person that when I drank until there was no more alcohol or I passed out. And in the morning when I would come to, because waking up was seldom, when I would come to and I'd say to myself, "I'm not doing this today. I'm not doing this today." I found myself doing this today nonetheless. And I couldn't ever stop when I wanted to stop. And over the years, other things creeped into the picture, but alcohol was always the big 10. It was the thing that I was always a part of my life. And I drank for many years. I ended up getting married a few times. A few more times than most people. And in an effort to be rid of ex-husband number two, I ended up moving to Savannah, Georgia. And this is a really big drinking town. And so I hit my bottom in Savannah, Georgia. And I hit it very, very hard back in 1997. And I ended up going into treatment and in a halfway house. And that's where I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. And so Alcoholics Anonymous started infiltrating my life because I was required to attend 5 12-step meetings of some kind. It didn't have to be AA. It could be NA. It could be CA. It could be any other A that they had around town. And there were quite a few, but I had to go to 5 12-step meetings a week, which I thought was really excessive, but I was willing to go to any lengths to keep a roof over my head. And so I did follow the crowd and went everywhere that I was told to go. And I had a roommate. And my roommate's name was Ricky, a female Ricky. And Ricky would get on her knees every night and she would she would pray and she would peer over the bed at me. And so she would guilt me into hitting my knees. And so I learned how to pray out of peer pressure. And that was the beginning of my prayer. I didn't have any kind of really God in my life. I had gone to church and I would say went to Sunday school when I was a kid, but God was really a character in a book I had never read. So I didn't have to unlearn anything about God, which was, I think, a boon for me. So I ended up not knowing God, but yet not unwilling to know God. And so while I was in treatment and in this halfway house, my journey with Alcoholics Anonymous began. And the person who was, there was two halfway houses, a men's house and a women's house. And the person who ran both of those houses, I took a hostage and he lost a job. And we ended up getting married and he became plaintiff number three. Is that right? Was he number four? Oh my goodness. It all runs together after a while, doesn't it? Yeah, because there was a guy in the middle of all of that. So please forgive me. In my old age, I can omit a husband or two, but no, I've been married five times. I know that's excessive too, but anyway, I digress. So I ended up marrying the person who ran that house. And I ended up in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, not in a treatment setting, which was new. And the very first meeting that I went to outside of a treatment setting, there was a woman speaking and sharing her story. And she was just so familiar to me. I mean, I know today that what that was I was identifying, you know, I was identifying with her story. And I got her phone number. I had been told to get phone numbers, you know. And so I got her phone number and I called her and she was not excited to hear from me because, you know, when we're new, we're kind of needy, you know? And so I asked her to be my sponsor. I had been told, for a while that you didn't need a sponsor to work steps one and two. This was from ex-husband number three, four. And so he was in the program, obviously. And so I had a real clear identifier for step one. I mean, somebody else was managing my life. Therefore, my life was unmanageable by me, right? So I didn't really have a problem with the fact that I had a problem with alcohol. I understood that clearly. What I had a problem with was my misread of step three, because for some reason, I really felt like that I couldn't turn my will and my life over to the care of God until I understood him. And so I went on this journey. I went on this journey in the agnostics chapter and I went looking for God. And I did that because what you told me in meetings was that every answer that I would ever need for any problem in my life, I could find in the big book. And I have found that to be true because the answer to all of my problems is God. And the book enables me to find that power greater than myself that will solve that problem, my lack of power, my problem, you know? And so I started looking in the book, and I don't know how many times I had read the agnostics chapter, but I was reading it one more time, driving back from a trip in a car. And I read that all that's necessary is a willingness to believe. And I was a little girl who always believed in Santa Claus, even after I understood that the man in the red suit didn't exist. I hope I didn't shock anybody there. But once I understood that the man in the little red suit didn't exist, I always felt like Santa Claus was that spirit of Christmas, that warm, wonderful feeling that I get every year between Thanksgiving and Christmas, where I'm nicer to people and you're nicer to people. And we just get the spirit of giving and everything's so wonderful, you know? And so I identified Santa Claus as being that feeling. And so here's what happened to me. I read and it said, all is necessary is a willingness to believe. And then I get, oh my God, I must be willing to believe because I'm looking so hard for the answer. Immediately followed by, in my pea brain, he sees you when you're sleeping. And the feeling that I get at Christmas time. And you know, the book tells us that if we approach God, he will approach us on a level of our understanding. That was my level of understanding. That was how God manifested in me, was through that spirit, that feeling of giving and loving. And I've never had to seek beyond that feeling to find God, because it's all about you now. It's all about giving. And that was the whole key for me, was to be able to identify God through a medium I already knew, which was Santa Claus. And so that was my beginning of my get to know God journey. That was like my jumping off place, the springboard. And so that's when I went home and I picked up the phone and I called the woman who was going to be my first sponsor. And I asked her if she would sponsor me. And she said, yes, I'm so not excited. But she told me that that she was a teacher by profession and we were in the middle of summer, and that I may need somebody else in the fall when she goes back to school, because I was very, very needy. And I would probably need somebody who's going to be more available than she was. But she got me through the first four steps. And I met with her the next Tuesday at our home group, and it was at a church. And we went to the chapel, and she got me on my knees, and we said the prayer that was in the book. And, you know, I got to tell you, I got it from that, and I just felt nothing, absolutely nothing, because I had absolutely no idea what was in front of me, and I was terrified. And she gave me some instructions on how to do step four right then, because she said, you never wait. As soon as you get up from your knees doing this prayer, you have to start work. And so she gave me work to do, and she got me through step four, and she got me through most of step five before her profession took her away from my life as much as I needed her. And I sought out another sponsor. And so my life has had very few sponsors. In the early part, it seemed like a lot in the beginning, but I really had very few sponsors. But the sponsor that I got was a little older, and she had a lot of medical problems. And she told me I would need a service sponsor. And so I ended up with this duet, both of whom I swear it looked like they should be sitting in a diner in the South somewhere with a little bouffant hairdo and all of that. But Miss Margie was, you know, my God connect, and Miss Betty was my service connect. And I had been sober. After I had been sober for about 14 months, someone came up to me at my home group and asked me if I would like to carry a meeting out to the county jail. And everything in me cringed, but my mouth said yes. And so my service journey began in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I brought meetings out to the jail. And when I walked into the door of the jail with this woman, she handed me a handful of grapevines. And she said, I bring these grapevines into the jail so that the girls will have something to read. They don't all have big books because we can't afford to bring them in. And so I looked at him and I flipped one over. On the back of it, she had written, if God was small enough for me to understand, he wouldn't be big enough to do me any good. And my need to completely understand God evaporated on the spot. So I went into this unit of women, like I'm in there with them. They're not bringing them out into a classroom or something. Like I am in the trenches with these ladies. And she helps me get the meeting started. And she said, I'm going to go get up and get started in a meeting in the other dorm. And she went, and I didn't see her again for 6 months. So I was flying by the seat of my pants, learning how to do corrections work and bringing in grapevines and having people donate their old grapevines. And I had a box in our meeting and a couple other meetings around town for people to donate their old grapevines and any books that they wanted to let go of and bring into the jail. And I got to talking to my service sponsor, Betty, and we decided we were going to get me a work kit. I annoyed the person in New York so bad that she sent me a work kit as if I were an area chairperson for corrections. And thank God she did, because I got so excited about it. And the whole thing about coins for cons, they called it then, or they had a variety of names over the pink cans, came out. And I ended up starting a committee, and we started Coins for Cons. And when we started the committee, I invited the area chairperson for corrections to come and to a workshop and talk to people in our area about corrections. And lo and behold, the next thing I know, I'm being asked to be the co-chair for the area for corrections. And I have less than 4 years of sobriety. You know, and so I haven't even been GSR. And so my very first major service position really was as an area chairperson. And I got to tell you that the little girl that walked in the door that couldn't talk to you had to grow up really fast. And of course, my biggest concern was I couldn't keep up with all of these people, you know, from Atlanta, being from Savannah. And I was just an idiot on fire, and I was ignorance on fire. And sometimes I think the ignorance on fire is better than the person who knows everything but keeps it hidden and won't do anything. But I started moving and shaking, and all of a sudden we had a connection with the Department of Corrections for the state of Georgia, because one of my old timers told me I wasn't doing my job and that was what I should do. And I was terrified, but I did it. I did it anyway, you know, and my sponsor said, it's okay to do it scared, just do it. And I never let fear keep me back, even though I wanted to most of the time. But it gave me the opportunity to travel all over Georgia and get to know people who were doing this work. Fast forward several years, and I have had the opportunity to serve as GSR of my home group, and I've carried several treasuries, including Coins for Cons, 3 times, and I got to be DCM and chair a state convention, serve as our area secretary, and then I was elected alternate delegate for the Area 16. And 2 weeks after I was elected alternate delegate, the delegate-elect resigned. And so I was thrown into the delegate position without any training. But, you know, there is always training as long as you're in service. You know what to do. It's just suit up and show up and ask for help. And so I learned how to do that job by suiting up and showing up and asking for help. And I felt like I hit the ground running, and we just did what needed to be done. And I didn't have to do it alone. And even before I became willing to stand for alternate delegate, I had a mentor who had served as delegate many years before. And he said, you know, after you're delegate, the only job you're able to have in AA is as a grapevine rep. And I'm like, are you serious? That's the only job I can have? He said, yep, that's all you can do. It's the only job you can have. And I said, you know what, David? I will stand for delegate if the only job I have to do isn't the grapevine rep. And then they put me on the grapevine committee. God has a sense of humor. You know what I mean? What a sense of humor. And you know what? It wasn't that I didn't like grapevine or that I didn't read grapevine. I just didn't know enough about grapevine to know what everything grapevine did. But I got to know about it really, really fast. And at my very first conference, I met Chris. And a bunch of other people, and the person who served as the chair before me and I, we still talk on a weekly basis, and he's been a huge asset for me in being able to learn what grapevine is. And so just last night, I was asked to give a presentation about grapevine. And, you know, grapevine is an amazing thing. It's come so far since the first issue in June of 1944 to today. I wonder sometimes what Bill would think if he could see where it is now. And it has really opened up our ability to serve the alcoholic in many, many more ways than we would have had it not grown the way it has. But here's the part of the other story. So I know you can see me. I can't see you. And it looks kind of stark behind me. And there's a reason that it looks kind of stark behind me, because in 2012, that jail that I had been bringing meetings into for 14 years hired me. And now I work at that same facility that I brought my very first meeting into in 1998. And the one of the things I said I'd never do was go back to school. And so I ended up having to go back to school to learn how to be a counselor. And there's a lot of difference between counseling and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I learned, if I had to put it down into a nutshell for me, in the counseling, we say, well, how do you feel about that? How does that make you feel? And in AA, we say, I don't care how you feel about that. You go feel about that all you want. But while you're feeling like that and thinking, believing whatever you want, go do this. You know, so I have to change how I act in order to change how I feel in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was true for me. But I have found that for some people, they have to change how they think, feel, and believe about something before they can change how they act. And that's why when it talks in the book where Bill puts in there that there, if you need a good doctor, go find one. And I, you know, I encourage that today. When I first started bringing meetings into the jail, I was very anti-treatment like that, which is crazy because I went through treatment, right? So it just is what it is. But here I am today. I've been working here for almost 14 years. And I now run a program for the women's substance abuse. And when I took this job, I told my boss, I would never allow my job to become my service work in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she agreed to allow me to do the things that I felt like I needed to do for my own recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And as a result, I was able to serve as the chairperson for a convention and your area secretary and the delegate and all the things, you know. And I'm truly, truly grateful. My life is so full. I think that if I had a dull moment, I wouldn't know what to do with it. You know, one of the blessings in Alcoholics Anonymous is that I'm doing what I want to do. I'm doing what I ought to do because I really want to do it. I want to thank you, Chris, so much for asking me to share my story. I wish I had time to tell you all of the little snippets, but I appreciate you allowing me to tell the pieces that I can. Thank you so much for having me. And with that, I'll pass.
Thank you, Liz. Great, great story. So glad you're with us in AA. I too grew up in a drinking home. I always joke that, you know, like my parents used to have keg parties when I was a little kid, you know, that's, but the drinking was a constant. And I too, my drinking was, you know, I didn't stop until I ran out or passed out, you know, and I also liked what you said. That same idea of being willing to believe, because I came in kind of agnostic, atheistic. I don't know the right description, but when it's asked in the big book, are you do you believe or are you willing to believe? I had to pause, and you know, I decided I was willing, and then all of a sudden, I had a real spiritual experience, you know. And and I also liked what you said, you know, my sponsor used to say, just act your way and to right thinking, because I would say, I'm, you know, I'm worried about this, I'm worried about that, I'm feeling this, I'm feeling that, and he would say, just act your way into right thinking. So I really appreciate you telling your story. I heard a lot of great stuff. Thank you so much. Before we get to our next speaker, we have a few announcements. The seventh tradition of AA states that every AA group should be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. AA members can help by contributing to your group, your local office, your area and district, and to the General Service Board. There's a great pamphlet called Self-Support, Where Money and Spirituality Mix, and you can find it on AA.org. Grapevine does not accept contributions directly, but of course we do have expenses. The best way to support Grapevine is to subscribe to the magazine, either in print, online, or on the apps. You can subscribe to the magazine in print or online by visiting aagrapevine.org. You can subscribe to the app by searching for AA Grapevine on the App Store on your phone. You can also purchase Grapevine books, greeting cards, and other items at your local AA office. By doing so, you'll be supporting both Grapevine and your local office. You can also visit Grapevine online on our store online at aagrapevine.org. The AA Grapevine Carry the Message Project allows you to help others by providing magazine subscriptions to those who are incarcerated, hospitalized, living in remote areas, or stuck at home. Visit aagrapevine.org and click on Carry the Message to learn more. We invite you to listen to our other weekly podcast, the AA Grapevine Half Hour Variety Hour, which is available for free on all podcast platforms and on aagrapevine.org. You can also follow Grapevine and Lavinia on Instagram and YouTube. And this is an announcement from AA World Services. The new season of Our Primary Purpose, the official podcast of the General Service Office of Alcoholics Anonymous, launches March 17th. Season 2 takes listeners on a journey across the fellowship, celebrating milestones, exploring how AA reaches anyone, anywhere, and shares stories that highlight the impact of service, self-support, and recovery in action. Tune in to hear how AA's message continues to reach those who need it most. Be sure to subscribe on your favorite streaming platform so you can catch every episode of the upcoming season. That's the podcast, Our Primary Purpose, the official podcast of the General Service Office of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our next speaker is having some connection problems, so he's going to stay off camera. But he and I have known each other for a number of years. We go to many of the same meetings here in upstate New York, Westchester County, and has become a good friend over the years. So let me introduce you to Scott.
Hey, everybody. My name is Scott, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Scott.
I'm so happy to be here. And Chris, thank you for inviting me. If you've never been to Stepping Stones, the history, the vibe, it just encompasses and surrounds you. I actually did a fifth step meditation workshop at Wits End and sat by Bill's desk and saw cigarette burns in the desk. I'm sober. I have long-term sobriety in three different 12-step fellowships, but the one that has changed my life and enriched my life has been Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sobriety date is May 22nd, 2001. I have a group. I have a sponsor that I'm in touch with constantly, and I have many sponsees, grand sponsees, great, great sponsees. I go to meetings in Westchester. Very often I see Chris, and I see guys coming over to me. Hi, great grandpa. I was like, oh, this is really nice. Liz, you know, we had so much identification. I was sitting here going, me too, me too. I've been married several times. This is my fourth. This one is the winner. We've been together for 33 years. The other three had to deal with my isms. Where else can we go and sit in a room where you might walk in as a stranger, but you walk out and you feel a connection? And the opposite of addiction is connection. My story began in New York. Maybe you can tell by a little bit of a New York accent. I was born in Brooklyn, born and raised. It was not the easiest upbringing. There were a lot of issues. There was a lot of violence. There was a lot of inferiority complexes, feeling less than, being overweight, being a bit of a brainiac, just not fitting in. And but one thing that I could do pretty well is hit a baseball. So that kept me, you know, from serious trouble until about 13. I started drinking right about that age and also dabbling. Both are deep in my history, but the drinking was always a constant. Made me feel taller, smarter, happier. It took me away from the problems that were going on in the house. An abusive parent who was terminally ill with cancer, no brothers or sisters. Growing up in the 60s, we didn't have the resources that we have today. You didn't have school counselors to talk to about addiction and about abuse at home. You didn't have Alateen. You didn't have a lot of what, thank goodness, is available in today's world. The Grapevine, where you can connect with people just by reading a bit of their story. So I had to figure things out on my own. And the disease is cunning, baffling, and progressive. Everybody that I hung out with had to be doing the same thing I was doing. And not all the time was it esteemable. And there's also been some borderline, behavior that, is a little bit off the edge. Honesty was a foreign word. Humility was absolutely a foreign word. Selfishness, hostility, quick-tempered, angry. My sobriety date is going to be, God willing, and Chris and I both celebrate in May, 25 years. Well, I got sober kind of late. I was 45. And I walked into a very powerful group, well known here in Westchester, heavy on service, heavy on the big book, heavy on steps, and outgoing meetings. We would meet in a parking lot, and these guys were strict. If we were a minute late, you're not going. And you had to reset your 90-day count. This was no joke. Sounded a little harsh. I caught some resentments along the way, but I knew from day one that I found a family that I always had longed for. People that understood my quirks, my assets, my liabilities, who would listen to my story and go, "Oh yeah, me too. I did that. I drank like that. I ran around like that. I felt like that." One of the most important lessons, and I was never, ever, I was a great starter, but not a good finisher. In my marriages, it was easier to go than to stay and work things out because it was all about me. I didn't realize that other people had a first step in their life, whether they're in the rooms or not. There's a lot of folks that are powerless over life circumstance, over their emotions, over their fears, over their anxieties. And when they get lost in that, just like we get lost in liquor, our lives become unmanageable. The principles of this program I carry with me deep in my heart. And when I'm sitting and doing step work with sponsees, I always remember the part of the book, a couple of parts of the book that just really impressed me. Avoid the deliberate manufacture of your own misery. We're not a glum lot. So on top of page 133, how many times have we all worried about something? I used to write things down on a piece of paper and put it away for 2 weeks and then look at it 2 weeks later. And 99% of the time, whatever I was fearful of didn't happen. But it was all these conversations going on in my head. And I don't know if anybody else could relate to it, but how many times did I revisit a resentment? Somebody who pissed me off maybe in 1977. And I'm thinking, well, why didn't I say this to them? My best thinking got me here. And what I had to do is I had to retrain my brain. So I worked with a lot of different sponsors over the years. I've been in a few different groups over the years. And at the age of 70, I'm going to steal a Jackson Brown lyric. I've finally come to see myself at last. Where who I am, what I stand for, what's important to me. Without the principles and the steps, I don't know. When I turned 50, I was amazed because the lifestyle that I was leading, I was running fast, I was running hard, I was a city kid. I remember complaining to my cousin, "I'm turning 50." And he said, "You're complaining? We didn't know if you were going to make it to 30. With the people you were hanging with, the things that you were doing, the way you were drinking." I would get a job on a Monday, quit on a Tuesday, and get another one on a Wednesday. But there was something endearing about my personality. At least some people thought so. And I remember there was one job, I sold consumer electronics in the 70s. And for an alcoholic in New York, there was not a better place to be. Music, stereo equipment, women flirting. It was a gas with other people that partied the way I did. And I remember being told on a Friday from one of my employees, we have to let you go. And I was a top producer. I was like, what do you mean you have to let me go? Don't you know who I am? Don't you know how much money I make for the company? He goes, I've never met anybody that had 12 different grandmothers die with funerals to go to. He says, don't you have any grandfathers? So we have to let you go. You're just not dependable. And when you're on, but when you're off, you're MIA. And that was a Friday. So what did I do? I walked in on a Monday and I punched in my time clock. Boss looks at me, goes, what are you doing? We fired you. I said, I know, but I really like it here. And they said, come on back. You know, I didn't have a lot of consequences. I finally did get arrested later on in life for a road rage incident when I was 14 years sober. You know, there's a little bit underneath that without the steps, without traditions, without these kind of conversations, retelling the story, that if I don't watch myself and think about my thinking and watch my words, and I was baited into a confrontation, a road rage confrontation, and I wound up getting arrested. And let me tell you something, for a guy who grew up a New York guy and thought he was a tough guy, I was reduced to tears. I was absolutely terrified. And we did manage to work things out, and I did community service, and I learned a lesson. And I no longer walk around with road rage. That's for sure. Gifts of this program. I don't like to tell too many war stories, and there's a lot, but you know, like all of us, it started out as fun, being a part of connecting, feeling older, feeling taller, feeling better looking, all of that, you know, the self-esteem stuff that I was lacking. And then it became fun with some consequences. Then it became nothing but consequences and headache. Not paying bills, not answering the phone, getting fired from jobs, getting married, not understanding that a husband needs to come home at night and not run around and do whatever he wants. I have three ex-wives, two passed away directly as a result of this disease. And like Liz had mentioned, I lost both my parents too, and I lost them very young. And I remember mourning them with a bottle of Jack Daniels. That's how I rolled. I didn't know how to grieve. Any kind of an emotion that felt overwhelming, I had to shut it away. I had to drink it away. I couldn't deal with it. It was too much sadness, too much pain, too much confusion. And again, there was no guidance. There was no mentor at that point in my life. I think about what we do in the rooms, how we are stewards for one another, how we mentor each other, how we identify as opposed to compare. One of the biggest gifts, I have two children. My son is going to be 49 years old. My granddaughter is an attorney down south, and she's going to be 29. They're not really in my life because of the wreckage of the past. My teenage daughter is very much in my life. She's everything to me. She is that part of the promise, or the promises, where I now understand intuitively how to handle situations that used to baffle me, where I understand how to be the parent that I so desperately wanted and needed for myself. But this program was the absolute forgiveness of my mom and all of the beatdowns and all of the abuse. And there was a lot, and it crossed a lot of different boundaries. But when in my heart, I was absolutely certain this is not who she was, it's not what she wanted. She was hurt, and hurt people hurt people. It opened up doors, it opened up possibilities. The other day, my wife and I got into a little bit of an argument. We do that. We bait each other, and we fall for the bait all the time. And I don't know if that's ever going to change, but we don't stay attached to it. So this was interesting, getting back to my daughter. She sent me this incredible text. She's 16 going on 30. I think she could absolutely be an analyst or a therapist if she wants to. And she said, I got to say, I don't mean to take sides. That's not what I'm saying. But Dad, I've kind of noticed that. And she just made some comments about me not listening, me talking over, me wanting to be right. And I thought about one of the old timers in my first group, and Chris might remember the name Jack, who was a major influence on so many people in recovery in Westchester County. And he said, on the tombstone for most alcoholics, this is what they're going to want to write. I was right, damn it. I was right. The need to be right had to be let go. Early on, I was in my 90. It was 2001. It was in the summer. And lo and behold, it was a Friday night. And my wife and I had a disagreement. I was at a red light and I was ready to go drinking. I was about 70 days sober. If I made a left turn, I was going to go into town to the local place that we would go to drink. If I made a right turn, I was heading to the church for both an open meeting and then after that, a beginner's meeting. I struggled, and I think if the light wasn't red, I might have just blown through that green light and made the left turn. But I thought about it and made the right turn. This was the only hiccup I really had in my 90. And I've been blessed. I haven't had any close calls or any desires or anything for 24 plus years. But I walked in that parking lot and Jack looked at me and he had this wink in his eye and this wonderful sense of humor. And he said a lot with very little. He said, "What's the puss on your face for? I've never heard such a thing. I've been married for 30 years. You're telling me that you had an argument with your wife and now you want to drink? I got to tell some of the other guys." He brings this guy George over, who had 40 years. He brings this guy Brian over. It's about 100 years, and they're working me. And Jack puts his arm around me the way an uncle would talk to a nephew. And he said, "Scotty, we're all very fond of you. You seem to be getting this program and you're involved and you're taking commitments and you're working at it. Here's the question. Do you want to be right or do you want to be happy?" I said, "Jack, I want to be both." He said, "Why did I not see that coming?" He said, "But if you had to choose, what's better for your soul and for your sobriety?" Then he asked me another question. Sometimes I ask my sponsees this question. "What's sobriety?" He said, "Scott, what's sobriety to you?" And again, I'm thinking this is a trick question. I have some college behind me. I got to know the answer to this. I said, "Jack, it's obviously not drinking and not using other substances." He said, "Now, it's how you respond to life and life's events. It's how you behave when nobody's looking. If we put a closed circuit TV camera on you and you got to watch the video later, would you be proud? Or would you be embarrassed?" Response as opposed to reaction. This program has taught me how to love myself, how to be appreciative and grateful for every moment, how to make my way when life gets a little tough, life on life's terms. My dad passed away when I was 23, maybe 24. And again, my idea of grieving was running around with a bottle of and partying. There's actually a picture of me that night. I had been sober about 3 years when the anniversary of his passing came, and it hit me like a ton of bricks. I wept. I crawled on the floor, banging the floor, "Daddy, Daddy, Daddy." And I felt all that grief, all of that sadness and anger. Because it was a relationship that could have been, but never was. And my wife, who is the most amazing person, came and held me and said, "What can we do to honor your dad?" And I thought about our favorite meal together, which was a chopped sirloin steak and mashed potatoes, peas and carrots, cornbread. And I said, "Well, that's a daddy dinner." To this day, once a year on the anniversary of his death, I have a daddy dinner. And I look up and I thank my parents and I thank my higher power for my lessons and their intent and their content and their purpose. So that's basically my story. And it was really lovely to spend some time with you. And thank you so much, Chris, for inviting me. I'll see you around town.
Great. Thank you, Scott. Really appreciate it. I could definitely identify with alcohol making me feel taller, smarter, happier until it, until I passed out or threw up on myself or whatever. And those fear illusions that you referred to, things like you can't even remember 2 days later why you were so upset, with such fear and boogeymen, right? I think you call it in the big book. And you and I are both lucky. I think the greatest reward of sobriety for me, probably for you too, is that we have children and wives who love us and who we love, no matter whether we fight or not, we love each other. That's so great. So we're going to close now, and I want to thank everybody, all the attendees, for coming today. Please let your friends know about our meeting. This is an open meeting, so it is also ideal for friends of AA who want to learn more about Alcoholics Anonymous. Keep this in mind when you're doing cooperation with the professional community or public information work. Liz, would you like to close the meeting with the prayer of your choice?
Thank you. Absolutely. Let's close with the we version of the Serenity Prayer. Moment of silence. Prayer. God, grant us the serenity to accept the things we cannot change, courage to change the things we can, and wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you, Scott. Thank you, Liz. Thank you,
Thank
everybody.
you.
Take care.